Good evening. Welcome to the Koach. Thank you all for coming. It's we're in Mitzvot. I wanted to thank Rav Shaffel for taking the time out of his very busy schedule to come teach us Torah tonight. Rav Shaffel teaches and learns Torah in many places throughout the city. He starts his day very early in the morning in this room, teaching Daf Yomi much before most people are awake. And we're very glad that he's able to share this series. Last summer he gave a series here on Kosher Money. In the winter, he gives a seminar for Kohanim and teaches a lot of things to the Kol. We're very grateful for his close participation and friendship to the Kol. So thank you very much, Rav Shaffel. One quick announcement. After this class tonight, so starting at 8:30 tonight and every Monday at 8:30, is a class given by Rabbi Kreisman in Tanakh, and it's going to be starting the Book of Koheles starting tonight. That's 8:30 to 9:30 every Monday night, and you're all welcome and invited to join us.
Okay, so we have planned is a three-part series that begins tonight. We're off next week, and then the following two Mondays are going to be on again. And each one, we're going to try and make it pretty much a self-contained discussion about the different aspects of women in mitzvahs. So tonight is going to be, for example, we're going to talk about women and mitzvahs in general, very general topics and principles which are involved. The second week, I think, is going to be women and tefillah. So we'll talk about a woman's obligation to tefillah and the hierarchy. A lot of it we'll spend discussing the hierarchy of one who has more or less time in the day. What should they say? What could be skipped? How do you go about prioritizing one's davening? And then the third week, we're going to talk about women and Torah study. Now, what you have in front of you is this packet. So there's a lot of sources over here, and why there are so many sources really relates to the justification of that. It's something which we'll have to come back that third week, which is 4 weeks from now, to understand why it is that way. We're not necessarily going to read everything inside because of time constraints, but we're going to try and touch upon the very basic principles of women in mitzvahs as the way Chazal present them. It's not going to be to explore necessarily the rationale why certain mitzvahs yes, certain mitzvahs no. All of that is a discussion which could begin really after we see what all the principles are. We can't really discuss those things until we know how Chazal, how the sages went ahead and understood the obligations. And then once all of that is in place, then that discussion could begin afterwards. But there's a lot of Chazal are pretty clear as far as basic principles are concerned. And it's worthwhile, my feeling, again, you'll come in 4 weeks, but my feeling is that it's worthwhile to see these things inside, to see the sources inside. In that way, it's by me, it resonates more, it's easier to digest, it's easier to process. I could refer back to it later on because I've actually seen something written inside. Okay, so we begin with source number one. No reason not to start over there. So here we find ourselves in a Mishnah in the Gemara in Kedushin. Very famous Mishnah. And the Mishnah over here lays down for us a number of rules, not only about mitzvahs and women, but it lays down for us rules as far as mitzvahs in general, different ways that we categorize mitzvahs. Now, a little bit of background in terms of Torah Shabbat Peh is necessary in order to us understand this. Up until the time of Rabbi Kiva, one of the great Tanaim, beforehand, so the way Halacha was studied was, it was studied as a series of random facts. Everybody knew what the halachas were on any given day, any given week, any given month. People knew what to do, but to sort of categorize it and codify it and put it together into coherent sections, that was something which was not really done. People studied the halachas, they memorized them, they spent a lot of time memorizing. After they had memorized the core curriculum of Torah Shabbat Peh, then much of what they spent their time doing was trying to trace that back into Torah Shabbat Peh, into the written law. So there's a lot of discussion about, you'll find in the Gemara, a lot of discussion about how do we connect these different ideas. So many times facts are taken as a given. Those are not really under dispute. And the whole disagreement is going to be, how do we trace this back to a pasuk? Is it pasuk A? Is it pasuk B? If I say it's pasuk A and you say it's pasuk B, what do I do with your pasuk? What do you do with my pasuk? And there's a lot of very vigorous debate which one finds in the Gemara related to those types of things, but the facts are all accepted. So here you have, from Rabbi Kiva and onwards, he was the one, the reason why he is known really as the architect, in the father of Torah Sheba'al Peh in many ways, is because he began to organize all Torah Sheba'al Peh into different concepts, into different units. So when we talk about, for example, 39 halachas on Shabbos, 39 activities you're not allowed to do. Up until the time of Rabbi Kiva, nobody thought of it in terms of 39. They knew you're not allowed to bake, you're not allowed to carry, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. Everybody knew what you're allowed to do and you're not allowed to do, but to organize it as a principle from which you're able to derive other applications, that was something which was really innovative that Rabbi Kiva did. So in Mishnayos, we find things which in our mind seems very obvious, but it was very obvious only because we are students of Rabbi Kiva. And we are students of Rabbi Kiva's methodology of teaching, trying to organize and group together like things and to be able to differentiate between different things. Okay, so we have over here, so the Mishnah says, source number one, just in time. It says, Kol mitzvah ben alav, any mitzvah, the way the Gemara explains this is, any mitzvah that a parent is supposed to do for a child, let's say, teaching them a trade, so anashim chayavim v'nashim pturos. Men are obligated, meaning fathers are obligated, women, the mothers, are not. And this is something in of itself would require an entire shir, which we are not going to get to now. We may touch upon this when we get to the section about the Torah study, but that's the rule number one. The Chol Mitzvah Sa'av Alaben, which Chazal interprets to mean anything which a child is obligated to do for a parent, Echad Anashim V'Echad Anashim Chayavos. Doesn't make a difference whether you're a son or a daughter, you have to honor your parents. It doesn't matter whether you're a son or a daughter, you have to have awe and reverence for one's parents. It's good for us parents. Now, next line is what's important for us over here. The whole mitzvah sase shehazman grama. Mitzvah sase means a positive mitzvah. Shehazman grama, that time, triggers the obligation to fulfill that mitzvah. As we're going to see in the Gemara, so Shabbos, for example. When does one observe Shabbos? Friday afternoon as the sun begins to set, so that time of the day triggers an obligation to observe Shabbos. As opposed to, let's say, as one of the examples in the Gemara would be, mezuzah. What time of day triggers an obligation to mezuzah? What time on the calendar triggers an obligation to do mezuzah? There is none. Right? It's when you buy a house or when you buy an apartment, then you have to do, but there's nothing related to the calendar. There's no connection between the calendar and the mitzvah. So that's a mitzvah to say, Shalom Azman Grav. It's not connected to time at all. So when we have those positive commandments, which are time-bound, meaning triggered either a point, a time on the day, or a date on the calendar, Anashim Chayavim V'Nashim Peturus. Men are obligated to those mitzvahs, and women are not. At any time there's a positive mitzvah, which is not at all related to time, not a time of the day, and not a date on the calendar, men and women are going to be obligated just the same. That takes care of our two categories of positive commandments. Positive commandments which are time-bound, positive mitzvahs which are not time-bound. Then the other section of the mitzvahs, the other 365 mitzvahs, are the prohibitions. So, what is there a difference between men and women as far as prohibitions are concerned? So, ben shazman grama, ben shlo azman grama, as far as prohibitions are concerned, it doesn't make a difference whether it's a prohibition which is time-bound, like Shabbos, or whether it's a prohibition which is not time-bound, which is, let's say, you know, one of the examples we have is a kohen becoming in contact with the corpse, becoming tameh. So, it doesn't have nothing to do with time. So, echad ha'anashim, echad ha'anashim chayav. So men and women are equal as far as prohibitions are concerned. So the only time we find a difference between men and women is in the positive commands, which are time-bound. Other than that, all the rest of the mitzvahs, men and women are the same. Chutz mi, and there were three exceptions to the prohibition rule, is bal takif. Men have a prohibition to cut off their payas, the corner of the hair on the corner of their head. Women don't have that prohibition. Ubal tashkis, men have a prohibition to take a straight razor to their beard. Women do not. About the time of the mason and the prohibition for a kohen not to come in contact with the corpse, that's something which applies only to males. Females, it does not apply. Okay, so these are the rules as laid down by Chazal. Now, where do these ideas come from? What's the origin of this? So that's why we have source number two, Tanur Bava. So this is about, if any time you need clarification, if you want me to re-explain or you have a question, feel free to chime in. So Tana Rabbanan, the Braisa teaches, a zoi mitzvah saseh shehazman grama. What's an example of a positive time-bound mitzvah? One which we said is either triggered by a time of the day or a day on the calendar. sukkah, lulav, shofar, tzitzis, and tefillin. So all of these, most of them, three of them are related to a yontif. So there's a certain day on the calendar which says you must sit in the sukkah, you must take a lulav, you must blow the shofar. And then there's some which are time of day. Tzitzis, when you wake up in the morning, you can see the difference between your blue and your green. Or tefillin is also around the same time. There's a time of the day when you become obligated to put on tefillin. So those are all either calendar triggers or time triggers, watch triggers. What are examples of positive mitzvahs which are not at all related to time? Mezuzah, as we said, there's no time of the day or date on the calendar where you have to put up a mezuzah. Makah, that's the obligation if you have a flat roof or you have a porch, which is, let's say, off of your bedroom on the second floor, which is used as another room of the house. So there's a positive command to put a fence around that to make sure that nobody shall pass the shalom fall. So that also has nothing to do with time. Aveda, the positive command to return a lost object, not time-related, not date-related. Vishuluach hakein, and sending away the mother bird in order to take the babies or in order to take the eggs. Also, whenever you happen to see a nest with the right type of bird, so then you have an obligation, nothing to do with time. Okay, so it seems to me that we should be able to now go through all 613 mitzvahs. We should be able to now categorize which ones women are obligated to and which ones not, because if it's a los ase, except for three of them, so 362 los ase, women observe the same as men, three exceptions to that. When it comes to positive commands, so there's two categories, those which are time-bound, those which are not time-bound, and seemingly it's going to fall very very neat and easy. To which the Gemara right away says, is this rule actually true? That if you take this to the bank and say that if it's a positive time-bound mitzvah, women do not have to do. And if it's not a positive, if it's a positive non-time-bound mitzvah, women are not obligated. Harei matzah, what about the mitzvah feed matzah? Simcha, the obligation to enjoy yontif. Hakel, the gathering together of the Jews following the Shemitah year and Yerushalayim year, the king read from Sefer Tvarim. The mitzvah sasei shazman grama, all of those are examples of positive time-bound mitzvahs, v'nashim chayavos, and women are obligated. So what we thought was a nice, clear rule, if it's time-bound, just mark it off here, just delete it, you're not obligated at all, that's not true, there's exceptions. Visu, and furthermore, on the other side of that rule, which are the positive, non-time-related mitzvahs, is it really true that women are obligated in those? Very Talmud Torah. What about the mitzvah of Torah study? Period, Beribia, the mitzvah to procreate and have children, who pijon aben and to redeem the firstborn, the lav mitzvah to say shazman gramahu, those are not mitzvahs which are related to time, and therefore women should be obligated in those mitzvahs, v'nashim peturos. And we know that women are exempt from that. So now we have what we thought were nice, neat rules. The Gemara now shows us, highlights and shines the light on the fact that these are not, it's not hard and fast rules because there's exceptions. So Mara says, Amar of Yochanan answers very simply, Ein lemeidin min akvalos. That when we say something categorically in the Mishnah, we don't really mean it to be in categorically. We mean generally this is going to be true, but we recognize that there will always be exceptions. So even though we say positive time-bound mitzvahs, women are exempt, there's exceptions to that rule. When we say positive mitzvahs which are not time-related, women are obligated, there's exceptions to that rule. And, as well, you'll see in the source number 301, he says that there may be as many exceptions as there are those that fall into the rule. So we state them again to try and create a structure that it should make sense in our minds, which yes and which not. But the truth is that there's no real, we're not tied strictly to these principles, and each mitzvah really has to be analyzed for itself. Okay, now. That tells us that we know that there are nice categories, but the categories have blurred lines. That's essentially what comes out from this. Now, one of the questions which has to be addressed, which is essential to address in order to understand the process, is how do we know that women are exempt from positive time-bound mitzvahs? Where did that come from? Nowhere in the Torah does it use the term mitzvah sasei shazman grama. Nowhere in the Torah does it go ahead and specify by particular mitzvahs to say women are obligated, women are not obligated. So where did Chazal come up with this rule? How did they know? How did Rabbi Akiva know? How did the author of the Mishnah know that there are two different categories of positive mitzvahs? One that women are obligated to observe, and one women are not obligated to observe, assuming, of course, that we don't have those blurred lines. So that's the second paragraph you have in source number two. And this is something which
Again, this relates to what I spoke about somewhat towards the beginning, that Chazal knew facts to be true, and what they spend their time doing, much of what they spend their time doing, is trying to recreate and explain how these facts fit into the Torah. So this is going to take you into what we like to refer to, I don't know how to use it outside of a shir such as this, but this is going to require our analysis of hermeneutical principles. Hermeneutical principles are that Chazal, again, different Tanaim had different styles, but they had a certain method by which they would analyze the text in the wording, in the phraseology of the Torah, and from that they're able to extract halachic lessons. For many, many years, this wisdom and this skill has been lost. When the common phrases, you can ask any of the people who come to the Daf Yomi here, when they ask me a question about a drasha, so my standard response, I don't have to say it anymore, I just point to somebody in the shir and they respond for me. My standard response is, I'm not a drashologist. There's a whole wisdom of drush, of analyzing text to extract halacha. I don't know that wisdom. The Malbim felt that to some degree he was able to recreate that, and that's much of what his pirish, that's much of what his commentary in Sefer Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvar, that's what he's doing, is he shows you how each word has a specific meaning and how it expresses itself in a halakhic context, as well as just in the regular prose of the Torah. But it's something which to a large degree is lost, but here's going to be an example of a hermeneutical principle at work, which is going to now generate for us this rule of mitzvah cessation as man drama, positive time-bound mitzvahs, when they are going to be exempt. Okay, so let's see if we can do this. So, mitzvah cessation, second paragraph of source 2. Mitzvah cessation as man drama, when it comes to positive time-bound mitzvahs, nashi peturos, women are exempt. That's what we have stated in the Mishnah. Minala. So how do we know that that's true? What's the source which says that women are going to be exempt from positive time-bound mitzvahs? Svar says, drama mitzvah. The Gemara says, we know this to be true, because we use tefillin as our model. Not tefillin, ushering keturos, just like women are exempt from the mitzvah of tefillin, which is a positive time-bound mitzvah, as we said, that there's a certain time of day which triggers the obligation. Kol mitzvah cessation as man grava, ushering keturos. So too, that's the model, so that now serves as a model for all mitzvahs which fit into that same category of positive time-bound mitzvahs, women are going to be exempt. Okay, beautiful. I know that's called the memasinu. What I find in one example, I can apply to the general principle, and that becomes my rule. Now the question which every one of you is asking yourself, you just are not comfortable enough knowing that you should shout out the question, that we said the example which we have is, all mitzvahs asay shasman grama, positive time by mitzvahs, are going to be derived from tefillin. And we took it as a given that women are exempt from tefillin. Who told you women are exempt from tefillin? The Torah certainly doesn't, in the context, in the wording of the Torah, the translation of the places where the Torah discusses the mitzvah of tefillin, it never says women are exempt. So it's wonderful. You're telling me tefillin is the model, and tefillin teaches me about all of the mitzvahs in that category. Well, who said that tefillin is the model? Who said women are exempt from tefillin? Maybe women are obligated in tefillin. If they're obligated in tefillin, then we've now obligated them in all the rest of the mitzvahs of tefillin as non grama. So the Gemara asked that exact question. With tefillin, so how do we know, with one word, because when I asked that question, the tefillin, how do we know that women are obligated in tefillin? Gomer love mitam the Torah. So we know that women are exempt from tefillin, because we know that women are exempt from Torah study. And therefore, matam the Torah nashim keturos, just like women are exempt from Torah study, atfillin nashim keturos. So too, by tefillin, women are keturos. They're also going to be exempt. Excellent. Now, see, now you're getting into the style of it. So now, we're doing an amazing inductive reasoning over here. We're saying, mitzvah cessation as man grama as a category is derived from tefillin. How do I know tefillin? Tefillin is known from Talmud Torah, the mitzvah of Torah study. Well, who said women are exempt from Torah study? So again, we seemingly get nowhere. We're spinning our wheels, and we haven't made any ground because we don't have a solid, definitive source that begins this whole thought process to exempt women from the cessation as man grama. So Gemara says, so the basis of this is, and this is something which is between the lines, again, that's part of the cryptic nature of the Gemara, is that if you look in the parsha of the Ahavta, in Shema, the first paragraph, so the pasuk says, v'shinamtam levanecha, we have one pasuk which says, there's an obligation to teach your sons, teach your Torah, and then it says, ukshartam. And then the next pasuk after that is the mitzvah tefillin. So since they are juxtaposed to one another, you have tefillin and you have Talmud Torah, So from that we say, it must be that just like they're exempt from Talmud Torah, which we'll get to, so too they're going to be exempt from Tefillin. To which Gemara asks, wait a minute, if you look in their last three psukim of the paragraph that I have over there, there are three mitzvahs which are mentioned over there. You have the mitzvah of the Shinamtam, Torah study, you have the mitzvah of Tefillin, and then you have the mitzvah of Mezuzah. Now what we are searching for is, we said, mitzvot asay are going to be associated with the mitzvah of Tefillin. Tefillin is in the middle. So now, which way did Tefillin go? Are we obligated in Tefillin or not? So he said, well, let's equate Tefillin to Talmud Torah, which is the pasuk before. And we'll say, just like they're exempt from Torah study, they're exempt from Tefillin. The Gemara says, why do you go from 2 to 1, why not go 2 to 3? If they just like number 3, which is mezuzah, which we said women are obligated to mezuzah, so too Tefillin, which is the pasuk before that, they should also be obligated. So I took in 1, 2, and 3. 1 is the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, which we're taking as a given they're exempt. Number 3 is the mitzvah of mezuzah, which we know they are obligated. And you have Tefillin smack dab in the middle. So which way do you go? How do we know? So that's the Gemara's question. The Gemara says, why did you go in the direction where you're going to exempt women? Why not go in the direction where you're going to obligate women? So the Gemara says, and this requires a great fluency in the knowledge of the psukim of the Torah. So he said, the Gemara says, Tefillin the Talmud Torah Yitzkash ben b'parsha Rishona ben b'parsha Shniyah. If you look in the parsha of the Ahavta and the parsha of Vayayim Shemoah, so there in both of those parshas, the order of the psukim changed slightly, but you'll find Tefillin and Torah next to one another in both of those two paragraphs. So in both paragraphs you have Tefillin and Torah next to one another, which creates a stronger bond. Tefillin the Mezuzah parsha Shniyah lo Yitzkash. But when you want to equate Tefillin and Mezuzah, that only is connected to one another. They're only juxtaposed to one another in the first paragraph, not in the second paragraph. So if you have two things which are next to one another in two paragraphs, you have two things which are next to one another only in one paragraph, we're going to go with 2 over with 1. Okay. So now, Gemara's done.
Question.
Yeah.
Why, I'm still not sure why women are not obligated for Torah study.
When they say Bar Nachav,
can't that mean
children of both sexes? Does it always just mean sons? I mean, everyone have that problem in the Torah too, and they say Anashim, or anything like that. What is the both, and what is it just meant? My answer is?
You're not a Rosh
Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, indeed. That's one of the great mysteries of when it is the gender neutral of the Torah will be masculine. That there is no gender neutral in Lashon Kodesh. There's either a masculine or there's a feminine. So when the Torah wants to be gender neutral, so the default is going to be in the masculine. So when Chazal knew, Vishinantam Levanecha, you will teach your sons, how they knew to translate that as sons rather than children, because the way you describe children is also going to be bani. Right? You're going to say, you're going to use the masculine. So when Chazal knew in those types of circumstances, to you that we meant gender neutral, and when they knew that it's going to be specifically the males, the boys, that's something which is I've tried researching numerous times. I've yet to find a definitive theory which is going to be able to explain all of these all the different differences. So I don't know, but again, this is something which that's why I gave you the introduction. The Chazal know these things to be true as fact, and we're trying to recreate the logic behind it. So as a result of that, so again, we go. It really what ends up happening in terms of the obligation of Torah study is you have those who are obligated to be taught, those who are obligated to teach, those then that comes around to Tefillin, which then comes around to Mitzvah Seisei She'azman Grama. So what seems to be this very simple rule, Mitzvah Seisei She'azman Grama, women are exempt, it takes about 3 or 4 steps of structure in order to be able to arrive at that conclusion. But that's the way the Gemara comes out. Now, if you look in source number 3, which is from Rav Shimshon Paul Hirsch. In this commentary, you see where exactly it's from. So he talks about, you see in the first page that you have over there, so he mentions that there are many exceptions to the rule. He talks about the most classic mitzvahs of Seisei Zman Grama, which are the most prominent in the life of a Jew, which are Shabbos and Pesach. There are no differences between men and women, that they observe Shabbos and they observe Pesach with all of the mitzvahs, Atzei and Los Atzei, the same. So he goes ahead and develops the theory, that's what you have on to the top of the next page, he goes ahead and develops the theory, which you could, accept it or not, it's the theory, that the mitzvahs of Seisei Zman Grama, the reason why positive time bound mitzvahs are going to be, are there, are to remind us of certain ideas
at certain times during the day or certain points on the calendar. And he says that men have a tendency to be more forgetful, and therefore they need constant reminders throughout the day and throughout the calendar for these different principles and these different concepts. Women have this innate sense of direction, an innate sense of purpose, an innate sense of where they're going, and therefore they don't need as many reminders, and therefore the Torah could go ahead and exempt them from those mitzvahs because they're not necessary for them. It's not something which is going to, it's not needed for them to be able to live their fulfilled life of service to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, it's a theory, but that's what the Levi says. Okay. Now, because of time-related things, so now in source number 4, we find that there are other times when there are other triggers where women can be obligated to do a mitzvah, even though it's a mitzvah cessation as non-grama. What's most prominent about the examples which are given over here, which are the times when the Gemara invokes this, is really 3 times the Gemara invokes this rule, and that is Megillah reading on Purim, Chanukah candles on Chanukah, and the 4 kosos, the 4 cups of wine at the Seder. So in all 3 of those instances, 3 different places in Shas, but it's the same name, so they invoke the rule, Sha'af Hein Hayiv Osanis, that they were also included in the miracle. And there's a disagreement between the Rashbam and Tosos what that means. Does that mean that they were also subject to potential destruction? They were almost killed in the Mitzrayim, they were almost killed in the Purim story, they were almost killed in the Chanukah story, and since they were recipients of the salvation, of the miracle of the salvation, they should also celebrate just the same. A second pirush, a second explanation for that is that Sh'atein Hayiv Osanis means that they were the cause of the salvation. In Mitzrayim, who is the one who made sure that there were babies and took care of the babies? Those were the mothers who acted with great mysterious nefesh, great self-sacrifice. In the Purim story, obviously Esther was an important figure. And in the Hanukkah story, you have Hannah, who was also involved in killing one of the Greek generals, which also was a major cause of the salvation. So that, on a Durabanan level, that also becomes a trigger for an obligation for mitzvah, Sha'ach Hein Hayiv Osanis. That they were also part of the miracle, those two different explanations for that. Now in source number 5 you have, we won't read this in 5 either, but source number 5 what you have is, you have the source that women are obligated in low sases, the same as men. That they are obligated to observe the provisions of the Torah, except those 3 exceptions mentioned in the Mishnah, they're obligated to observe all of those the same. Over here, interestingly enough, we have, as opposed to the first case, we're trying to figure out the exemption from mitzvah cessation as non-grama, where we were sort of like grasping at straws to find the definitive source which is going to teach it to us. In source number 5, you actually have an abundance of sources. We have, with different tanaim, find 3 different sources which obligate women to observe prohibitions the same as men. Not filing prohibitions, but to observe the prohibitions the same as men. And then the Gemara has to go out of its way to explain why 3 different sources are necessary. Because there's no such thing as anything superfluous in the Torah. And if I have 3 different sources for the same principle, for the same concept, it must be because none of these sources individually will be able to paint the full picture. So I need all 3 sources in order to be able to paint for me the full picture of a woman's obligation in mitzvahs. And that's really what we have in source number 5, which is also a Gemara straight out of Kedusha. Okay. Now, one of the burning questions which results from this, and this is something which is essential, certainly in the 20th century, 21st century Judaism as it's practiced by us, is that we know that even those mitzvahs from which women are exempt, let's say lulav, let's say sukkah, let's say shofar, which everybody agrees that they are exempt, to a large degree, women go out of their way to observe that mitzvah. Is that appropriate or not? Maybe. Now there's a concept in Chazal, comes from the Gemara in Yerushalmi, which says that if a person fulfills a mitzvah from which they are exempt, they're considered foolish. The classic example where you find that cited in Halakha is it's raining Sukkot, let's assume it's not the first night, so the first day of Sukkot, it's raining, it's pouring cats and dogs, like it was this morning. morning. Like it was raining hard kind of like this morning. And a person says, so if it's raining, we know one is exempt from sitting in the sukkah. You don't have to sit in the sukkah if it's raining. Let's say a person decides, you know what? I want to sit in the sukkah anyways. Even though it's cold and it's wet and it's windy and all of those different things, I'm going to sit in the sukkah anyways. So Chazal say that since that person is exempt from sitting in the sukkah because of weather conditions, and they do so anyway, it's considered to be foolish. So the question is, if women are exempt from mitzvah sasei shehazman grama, and they choose to fulfill it anyways, do they fall into that category? Is that considered to be that category of one who's exempt from a mitzvah, and not only are they exempt, but they really shouldn't, they should be discouraged from doing so, because it's foolish to think that God said I don't have to do this, who am I to decide, well, this is appropriate for me to go ahead and do? Maybe that's running counter to God's intent. So you have over here, in source number 6, it looks like it's a lot of material, there's about half or a third of what the Ron actually writes in great length. This is one of the, it's a very famous Ron, and it's very lengthy where he talks about it at great length. But he analyzes this question. This question was a topic which was discussed by the Rishonim, which was debated by the Rishonim. If a woman chooses to fulfill a mitzvah saseh shazman grama, is she allowed to do so or not? The reason why she may not be, and this is something which he discussed over here in the first paragraph of that, is because the classic example, the place where we find the Tanayim disagree about this matter is, the Torah says that before bringing a korban, before an individual brings a korban, an animal sacrifice, so there's a general mitzvah to do smicha. To do smicha, which is, place both of your hands, assuming it's like a sheep or a goat that you can actually reach down, otherwise a bull, it'll be like this. But you take your hand, you put it on the head of the animal, on the top of the head of the animal, and you lean your weight on the head of the animal. And if it's related to a sin, there'll be a confession which is said at that time, but there's a mitzvah of smicha, leaning on the head of the animal. Chazal understand, here's another example, they say, Deber b'nei Yisrael, that the men do smicha, women don't do smicha. There's a machlokas, leaning on the head of the animal. So now there's a disagreement amongst Tanaim. If a woman who's bringing a korban, and there's nothing wrong with her donating a korban, bringing a voluntary offering, if she does so, can she do smicha? So seemingly we would say, well, why not? Certainly it's not going to hurt the animal. The animal's going to be dead soon anyway. We assume that she's not going to actually harm the animal when she leans her weight on the head of the animal, so why shouldn't she be allowed to do so? So they point out, this approach of some of the tonight, that to lean on the head of the animal, one is not, once an animal is sacred, sacred cow. So once you have your sacred cow, you're not allowed to use it to benefit yourself personally at all. You're not allowed to get any personal benefit from a sacred animal, a sacred object. That's the Isser of Me'ilah. That happens to be the name of the prohibition. Mem Ayin Dud Lamehe, Me'ilah. So now, if a person goes ahead and leans on the head of the animal, so the animal's providing support for their weight, and they're not obligated to do so, maybe that's a personal benefit. Maybe that's considered to be a personal benefit that one is getting from the animal, and then it's not just that a woman is exempt from that obligation, but it becomes offensive. Because now you're taking personal benefit from the animal itself, because now it's supporting, just like you're not allowed to jump on the back of the animal and ride around the base of meekness one last time before you go ahead and offer it as a korban. So by the same token, leaning one's hand in one's weight is a smaller expression of that, but a similar type of thing. Take, for example, the shofar. Shofar, is one allowed to play musical instruments on Shabbos or Yom? Certainly not. Right? One is not allowed to. So now, if one has a mitzvah of shofar, so then the Torah says, you blow the shofar, you make the sound, so you go ahead and do so. If somebody does not have the mitzvah of shofar, are they allowed to play a musical instrument? Then also, maybe not. Maybe that's considered to be a violation of yontif to play a musical instrument if it's nothing done for the sake of the mitzvah. So if a woman decides she wants to blow shofar for herself on Rosh Hashanah, is she allowed to do so? Is she not? So it's a machlokas tanaim. So there's two schools of thought within the tanaim, whether or not women are allowed to fulfill a mitzvah, voluntarily fulfill a mitzvah to say shazman grama or not. The Ran says, we paskin, like the opinion that says it's acceptable. That there's nothing wrong with it. He actually proves it later on, which we may read inside, may not. But he comes out with the conclusion, and that's what you have in the middle of 6, source 6, in the bold print over there. So it says, living in halacha, as far as the halacha is concerned, because it's always nice to debate things, but we need to have some practical resolution. So as far as halacha is concerned, Nakina Rav Yossi v'Rav Shimon. So the halacha is going to follow the position of Rav Yossi and Rav Shimon, Rav Yossi nimuko imo. Because Chazal say Rav Yossi was really smart. that's essentially what it was. He was a very deep person, and as a result of his death, whenever he gets into a debate with somebody else, almost always the nod is going to go in the direction of Rabbi Yossi. So he has some sort of carte blanche, you know, path to be able to get his opinions accepted in halacha. Hilkach, therefore, in Rasu Nashu Masos Kol Mitzvah Tzeisha Azman Zama, if a woman wants to go ahead and fulfill any positive time-bound mitzvah, her reshus biyado. It's perfectly acceptable for a woman to go ahead and voluntarily blow shofar, take blow vinesho, sit in the sukkah, etc. V'lo chayshina l'bal tosif, we're not afraid that fulfilling a mitzvah from which she is exempt is a violation of adding on to a mitzvah. You have a certain number of mitzvahs you're supposed to do. If you take on an additional mitzvah, maybe that would be a violation of adding on to the mitzvah. V'lo l'shvuch t'tikia, and it's not a violation of yontif, of blowing a musical instrument. Now, the next question, as we work sequentially through this process. So we said, mitzvah cessation as man grama, the Torah exempts from it. We've now come out and said that if they want to fulfill that mitzvah, they're allowed to do so. What's the next question which has to be addressed, the burning question, which immediately follows the fact that they could do the mitzvah?
You better want to mention guess what?
Exception.
Not exception. That would never also there, right? One would accept.
Before we even get to the exceptions, if you can't fulfill the mitzvah,
does it mean you have to? Even it doesn't mean that you really should go strongly out of your way to do so.
That, right. That also, but that will be a second thing, even before we get to that. The question is going to be, should you, right? The question, again, also before that, the question is going to be, to make a bracha. What's wrong with making a bracha? The problem is when a person takes lulav v'nesrot, for example. So they say, asher kiddushanu v'mitzvot v'tzivanu. Right? Asher kiddushanu, you have sanctified us v'mitzvot with your mitzvot, v'tzivanu, and you have commanded us to take a lulav. Now, if a woman is not commanded, how could she say that bracha? It would seem to represent an expression of a falsehood to some degree to say, Vitzivani, you commanded us to go ahead and do this mitzvah. No, you weren't. You're never commanded. You're allowed to do the mitzvah. Because we pass the like a message that you're allowed to do the mitzvah. But is it going to be permitted to go ahead and say the bracha of Vitzivanu? It potentially runs the risk. Not only is it false, but if you're not obligated to do so, it becomes what's called in halacha a bracha in a tricha. It becomes an unnecessary bracha, which is itself offensive to God because it's a form of taking his name in vain. If you drink a cup of water, you made a shahako, and you plan on drinking a second cup of water, but you want to make more brachas because you feel comfortable doing it. So you make a brain of freshness after the first cup of water, and then immediately after you finish that, you're parched again, and you make another shahako and drink a second cup, and then you make a brain of freshness, and then you make another shahako for your third cup. So even though each bracha was appropriate, because you did make a shahako because you're about to drink something, those are all, bracha number 2 and 3, are bracha shein tzricha. They were unnecessary, because your first bracha was going to cover all 3 cups. So making additional brachas when they're unnecessary is a violation. It's a form of taking God's name in vain. So the next burning question, this one is not resolved, is akmo. We'll see in a moment. But the question is going to be, is a woman going to be permitted to make a bracha on the mitzvah to say shazman bracha? And this becomes the topic of the next paragraph that you have in the Ran, and you try to determine whether women are going to be obligated or not. So the first thing he says, as far as, which we won't read inside yet, but he says, as far as the concept of bracha shein tzricha, making a bracha which is unnecessary, he says, that is true, that's a problem only when the bracha is completely unnecessary. As you said, you already made a shahako, there's no reason to make another shahako. So therefore, to make that second shahako is a bracha shein tzricha. But over here, if a person is going to be doing the mitzvah, so it's not shein tzricha, it's part of the mitzvah. Associated with the fulfillment of the mitzvah is going to be the bracha. Now what about the word vitzivanu? That potential falsehood which exists within the word. How could you say vitzivanu if you weren't actually commanded? So to this, the Ran takes a very straightforward and a very simple approach. And he says, what is the tense? What's the tense of the word vitzivanu? Not tense. What's the...
It's plural.
Plural, excellent. Thank you. What's that? Tense?
No. Singular plural.
How is it conjugated? So it's conjugated in the plural rather than the singular. So nobody says, nobody pronounces it. they don't mean to pronounce it. Some people do say Vitzivani. But they mean to say, even though they say Vitzivani, they really need to say Vitzivanu. That's just their pronunciation becomes Chassidus. It becomes Vitzivani. But nobody actually says it in the singular. Nobody says that I was commanded in the mitzvah. The language of the bracha is always going to be in the plural. We were commanded to do the mitzvah. So as long as it's a mitzvah which we, the collective we of Klal Yisrael, are commanded to fulfill, so there's nothing wrong, according to the Rambam, for a woman to go ahead and also say, Vitzivanu, because she's not saying that the command was directed to her personally. She's saying that Klal Yisrael was commanded to do this mitzvah, which I'm about to do. And therefore the Rambam says it's perfectly acceptable for a woman not only to do, to fulfill, to perform a mitzvah sasei asman grama, but the Rambam comes out that even to make a bracha is perfectly acceptable. Now, that's not accepted in halacha by everybody. The Rambam very famously holds that women did not make a bracha mitzvah sasei asman grama. And now this becomes a division. This is one of the very core divisions which you find, which separate, where you begin to see in the time that we showed them, different practices developing between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. Because to this day, this machlokes, this disagreement about making a bracha on the mitzvah sasei asman grama is one of the great unresolved. Because both opinions make their way into Shulchan Aruch. And that's really what you have in source 7. We'll read the first part of it, again, just because you'll be able to say that you've seen inside. So he says, this is the Orach Chaim Siman Tuf Chof Bei Tes Zivah, is dealing with the mitzvah of shofar. So shofar is a classic example of a mitzvah sasei shazman grama. The calendar date, Aleph Tishrei, kicks in, bam, you have an obligation to go ahead and blow shofar. So he says, Avavi Shanashi Peturos, even though women are exempt from the mitzvah of shofar, Yuchol Osnitzchol. If they want to go ahead and blow the shofar, Gezunta, hey, blow to your heart's content, it doesn't make a difference. It's a wonderful thing, it's a fulfillment of a mitzvah. A voluntary mitzvah, but a fulfillment of a mitzvah. The Ve'acha Shiyatukar, and somebody who has already fulfilled the mitzvah, Yuchol Yitzchol Osnitzchol. So he is going, a man will be able to blow the shofar a second time for women who would like to be yosei the mitzvah, even though they're not commanded to. Nonetheless, he could blow the shofar in order to help them discharge their obligation. Aval, ein mevarchos, but, this is the Shulchan Aruch, following the opinion of the Rambam, but they should not make the bracha, velo yivarchu lehem. And if a man is blowing shofar for a woman, so he is not going to make a bracha for them. So Shulchan Aruch follows the opinion of the Rambam, that even though a woman is allowed to fulfill the mitzvah of sasei asman grama, he is of the opinion that they don't make the bracha. Hagah, it's on the second line over there, Hagah, usually in the Shulchan Aruch itself, you change the font to indicate that you've now switched from the Shulchan Aruch to the Ramah. You've now switched from the Sephardic approach to Halacha to the Ashkenazi approach. The Haminog, Shalashi Mevarchos HaMitzvah Sasei Shazman Grama. So the Ramah says that our custom is that women do make a bracha on a positive, time-bound mitzvah. And therefore, even in this context of shofar, if a woman is going for herself, a man is going for a woman is going for other women, whatever the circumstance is, we find nothing wrong whatsoever with the Ashkenazim, find nothing wrong whatsoever with a woman making the bracha on a mitzvah sasei shazman grama. Okay, so we've taken, up until this point, we've taken a journey, for the most part, exploring this concept of mitzvah sasei shazman grama. We stated categorically that women should be exempt. We realized there are a number of exceptions to that rule. We saw the source for that rule, how we know that they're going to be exempt. And now we got this whole discussion whether they should do the mitzvah anyways voluntarily, even though they're exempt, and whether or not they're going to be able to make a bracha on that mitzvah which they're going to fulfill the same, and that ends up breaking down in terms of party lines, for the most part, Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Okay, so now, here comes one of our challenges to this rule. We'll try and do it quickly. Source number 8. So it says, Shulchan Aruch says, Nashim chayavos b'havdalah, kishem shchayavos b'kiddush. Women are obligated to say havdalah at the end of Shabbat, the same as women are obligated to recite Kiddush at the beginning of Shabbos. Now right away, we didn't explore this. How do we know that women are obligated to the observance of Shabbos, let's say making Kiddush, is a mitzvah sasei shazman grama? Friday night comes along, that time in that calendar date triggers the obligation to say Kiddush. Why are women obligated to say in Kiddush?
They're obligated to keep Shabbat.
Excellent. Okay. So there's Zachar and Shamor. Zachar and Shamor are considered, even though they're far apart, but they're considered to be juxtaposed conceptually to one another. So there is Zachar, which is the mentioning of Shabbat. That's the recitation of Kiddush at the beginning. Shamor is the observance of Shabbat, meaning don't violate the prohibitions. So Chazal understand anybody who is bound by the prohibitions of Shabbat is obligated, and the Zachar is obligated to mention Shabbat at its outset as well. So now, that's as far as Kiddush is concerned. There's a machlokas whether or not Havdalah is in the same category as Kiddush. Are they both Deoraisa? Is there an obligation to mention Shabbat as it commences and mention Shabbat as it ends, Kiddush and Havdalah? Or is there really only a biblical obligation to mention Shabbat at the beginning and the obligation of Havdalah is Durabana? And Shulchan Aruch brings down two opinions. Whether or not women are obligated in Havdalah or they're not obligated in Havdalah, but we're not so concerned about that. Then Havdalah, therefore the Ramah says, a woman should not make Havdalah for herself. She should listen to Havdalah being recited by a man. I have neighbors. The only time I know that this neighbor's, the husband of their house, is out of town for Shabbos is when I come home after Shabbos, all of the women have gathered into the house so that I can make Havdalah for all of those women. So that's how I know that he must have been out of town because they're all over. Now the question is, Ramah says over here, the thing that there's a disagreement whether women are obligated in Havdalah, they shouldn't make their own Havdalah. Now bells and whistles should be going off in your head because all of you are now experts in this topic. We said that there's a machlokas. So the question is Havdalah a mitzvah to say Shazman Rama, or is it not? Now we know that that's an academic question. Because if a woman wants to fulfill the mitzvah anyway, is she allowed to do so? Certainly she's allowed to do so. If she wants to do so and recite the bracha, is she allowed to do so for us Ashkenazim? We say yes. So now there's a question. Is Havdalah a mitzvah to say Shazman Rama or not? What the difference is it? If it is a mitzvah to say Shabbat, if it's not a mitzvah to say Shabbat, it's like Kiddush, so then a woman has to say Havdalah the same as Kiddush. And if it's only Durabanan, if she wants to do so voluntarily, she should be allowed to do so. So either way you go, it doesn't make a difference which opinion you follow, the net result should be nothing wrong with making Havdalah. So why is the Ramah all of a sudden coming along and throwing this monkey wrench in, and he's saying when it comes to Havdalah, because there's a disagreement how to categorize it, they shouldn't make Havdalah for themselves. Why not? This is a huge question, huge, huge question, which the commentators to Shulchan Aruch, they explore and they analyze and they debate and they try and figure out, again, as we work deductively, suddenly now that we discover a new exception to the rule, so once I discover an exception to the rule, I have to rework my original rule to figure out how this is going to fit into my revised theory. So the revised theory, the most common or the most popular of the revised theories is what you have in source number 9 from the Magen Avraham. And he says over there, essentially, he comes up with a theory that there's a difference between two different categories of mitzvah sasesha as mangra. Again, as we think analytically and we try and figure out the differences, one of these things is not like the other. So that's the game which we're taught as children, and then we apply it as we get older as well. He says that the whole discussion of the Ram about a woman fulfilling a mitzvah sasesha as mangra voluntarily, and not only fulfilling that mitzvah voluntarily, but reciting the bracha, that applies to those mitzvahs that say shazman grava, those positive time bound mitzvahs, where there's an action to perform, and then a bracha that you make before performing that action. Taking lulav and etrog and shaking it is an action. I recite the bracha before that action. Sitting in the sukkah is an action. I sit myself down to have my meal, and I recite a bracha before it. But what happens, so you pick out your thumbs, but what happens when you go ahead and the whole mitzvah is only to recite a bracha? There is no action. Like in Havdalah, now don't get confused, because the bracha on wine, and the bracha on the sun, and the bracha on the fire have nothing to do with Havdalah. We group them together just because it's convenient to group them all together at one time, but all Havdalah, all that's required for Havdalah, and you know this to be true, because it's the same Havdalah that you do after Yantif, is you just need to say Hamakyu. So, comes along the Magen Avraham and says, to explain the Ramah, he says that when we say it's perfectly acceptable for a woman to recite the bracha on a mitzvah to say Shazman Rama, that's when there are two parts to the mitzvah. There's the action of the mitzvah, and there's the bracha which is recited on that action. But when the mitzvah and the bracha are the same, they're one thing, like Havdalah, that, he says, women do not do. That's the theory that the Magen Avraham generates. And he says, in light of that, he says, I cannot explain something which bothered me for many, many years. Why don't women say, Ashkenazi or Middle East, why don't they say Kiddush Levana? Kiddush Levana may be a mitzvah to say Shas Man Grama, but why don't women voluntarily go outside at the beginning of the month, as soon as the moon is large enough and it's a clear eye, why don't they make Kiddush Levana? So he says, it bothered me. I couldn't understand why women, of all different mitzvahs of Seisha as non-grabber, women are doing. They do shofar, they do lulav, and they do sukkah, and they do all of those things, and you don't find women doing Kiddush Levana. Why is that? So the Magen Avraham says, this fits within my theory. Because my theory was that we differentiate between when there's an action and a bracha on the action, which is acceptable, and if the entire mitzvah is the bracha, that women don't do. It doesn't explain why, but he says it's a separate category and they don't do. And if we accept that premise, we accept that theory, we can now explain why women don't make Kiddush Levana. Because Kiddush Levana also, there's no action that one does during Kiddush Levana, it's just the recitation of the bracha. So whenever the mitzvah of say is, sometimes it's only to make the bracha, then women don't do that.
But you have to go out and look at the moon. Isn't that considered an action?
If you're not doing anything physical, you have to see that, because that's like the bracha that you make on lightning. You're not doing an action to make a bracha on lightning. When you observe lightning or you hear thunder, so then there's a reaction that you have, which is the bracha itself. But you're not performing an action of a mitzvah. Okay. So that is the theory of the Magen Avraham. That's what's brought down. Okay, now 10 and 11... we have to do quickly, just because we'll have Minchat 8:15 next door, so I have to run over there. But 10:11, so you have a fascinating idea. You have, if you look at just that very last line of source 10, in the middle of the line it says Aval. What he's discussing before and leading up to it is not going to be so germane. But he says, Aval Isha, Ein Bechlal Ha'aros. Women are not included in the principle of Ko Yisrael Arevim Zevazeh. And therefore, she's not going to be able to be mostly other people in the mitzvah. Now, there's a concept, and we have to try and do this quickly, but there's a concept that if somebody needs to fulfill a mitzvah, and let's say Megillah reading, or let's say shofar blowing. So why is it that one person blows the shofar and everybody else listens? Why not have everybody blow the shofar for themselves? If the mitzvah, the Torah doesn't say, have the chazan blow shofar for everybody else. So the Torah says that on Rosh Hashanah, you blow the shofar. Seemingly, maybe everybody should obligate to put on tefillin. We don't have one person put on tefillin, and the whole minyan is yotzei tefillin because one person put on tefillin. So why is it that by shofar, one person blows the shofar, everybody else fulfills the mitzvah? So there's a concept of aris. There's a concept of collective responsibility. That collective responsibility says that we're connected to one another in a way where one person could act as the representative for the entire group, and that person's action counts as if everybody else did it. So one person blows the shofar. The principle of Arba says it's as if everybody went ahead and fulfilled that mitzvah. So the Rush says, and it's a little reading of his word, he says, women are not part of that principle of Arba. Okay. I'm not sure what just looking at the Rush itself, we would not be aware of what the practical implications of that is. But then you have the Tshuva Sur D'Kivayger. Tshuva Sur D'Kivayger starts by quoting the Dalga Mervava. Dalga Mervava is known by different names. He's known the noted Yehuda. He's a Tetzel Landau is his name. If you have children, say it's the longest Pesach. Will be the story about him. But he came along and he said that he has a strong question against the practice which happens week in and week out. We said that there's a mitzvah, d'oraisa, to mention Shabbos, to recite Kiddush at the beginning of Shabbos. Chazal came along and added a derabbanan to that Kiddush should be recited with a cup of wine. But midaraisa, as soon as you mention Shabbos at the beginning of Shabbos, like with the paragraph of Vayichulu, so you've already made verbal mention of Shabbos, you fulfilled your Torah obligation of Kiddush. So he says, let's play out a common theme in Jewish homes throughout Klal Yisrael. The men went to Shul. They said Vayichulu. They said in Shmon Esrei. They said it collectively. They may have heard Kiddush recited in Shul. They may have three Vayichulus under their belt. Seemingly, they fulfilled their Torah obligation to recite Kiddush. The women who did not go to Shul, they may have been putting together all the last-minute things which happened at the beginning of Shabbos. They may not have got one. They may have just decided to rest because finally the men left. We could relax them. So now we go ahead. They have not yet daven Marv. So she comes to the table. What's her obligation to recite Kiddush? Her obligation is still d'oraisa. She hasn't davened at all. So she still has a biblical obligation to recite Kiddush. So what usually happens? The men come home. Shalom Aleichem. Eishes Chayil. Then the man recites Kiddush. He reads Kiddush. What's his obligation to recite Kiddush at that point?
Yeah.
His Durban. His rabbinic obligation, which is stage two. What's the woman's obligation at that point to say Kiddush? She has a Deraisa. Now, normally, for someone with a Durban obligation to be motzi, to discharge somebody who has a Torah obligation, that's acceptable if they're connected to one another with the principle of Arvus. But if we take the Rush literally, who says women are not part of the principle of Arvus, you have this huge problem because he's saying Kiddush when he's only obligated to Rabbanan, and she has the biblical obligation, and if there's no Arvus, he can't be motzi her because her obligation is greater than his. So how does that work? That's the double Rabbanan's question, and he doesn't resolve that question. Now you should know, there are certain subgroups within Klal Yisrael where women have the practice that the only time they daven Maariv is Friday night. Seemingly to address this issue of the Dagim Ravava. That that's the only time they daven, and they do so specifically before the meal, in order that they should be on an equal plane when it comes time to actually say Kiddush. But that's the question of the Dagim Ravava. Comes along Rabbi Kiva Eger, and he says, you misunderstood the Rush. He says the Rush should not be understood literally as you, the Dagim Ravava, understood it. What he meant was that if a woman is not obligated in the mitzvah at all, then, like say shofar, so then she can't be an arvus, she can't guarantee a mitzvah that she has no relationship to whatsoever. When it comes to Kiddush, for example, she does have an obligation to that mitzvah of Kiddush. So as long as she's obligated in the mitzvah, she can serve, and if the principle of arvus, the principle of guarantorship, is going to apply, which allows him to make Kiddush for her, her to make Kiddush for him, because all you need is that they share that obligation. The only time you'll run into a problem is if there is no obligation in the mitzvah altogether. So if a woman to blow shofar for a man, since she's not obligated in that mitzvah from the Torah, she's not going to be able to do so. Because she can't guarantee a mitzvah she's not obligated to do. But since Kiddush, women are obligated the same as men, so even if it happens to be the circumstances, her obligation at the moment is deraisa, and his is only derabanan, but they're both obligated in the mitzvah. So as long as they're both bound by that mitzvah, they can guarantee one another's fulfillment of the mitzvah, and there's nothing wrong with the man who has the derabanan obligation to go ahead and make kiddush for any woman who has the deraisa obligation, because arvus is still going to apply. That is a basic tour, as it were, of women's obligation in mitzvah in very general terms, in terms of very general principles. As we said, that the next week in Reis Hashem, we will explore in more detail the origin of women's obligation to daven, and as we said, very specifically, the hierarchy, the priority list of what she must daven if there's a time, depending on the amount of time, and then, which is not next week, it's in 2 weeks from now, and then 4 weeks from now, or 3 weeks from now, so the last part of this series is going to be a woman's obligation to study Torah. I appreciate very much your attentiveness.
Thank you.
And I'm sorry that...
Two weeks.
There's a sign up there on your way up. Okay. Not the 27th, but the 4th.
I want to make sure I'm in email, but I know that my friends who have a lot of